Hello and welcome to episode 55 of Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. We are joined, of course, by Bo, who will be talking all about the life and times of Henry VI, England's arguably worst king who lost the Hundred Years' War and the Wars of the Roses. So without further ado, let's get straight into it.
Okay, yeah. So Carl's not in today, so I thought we'd go back to something that I'm sort of very comfortable with, so the English Middle Ages. I've said in the previous epochs that I'm a sort of a massive fan of Henry V, and, you know, not going out on a limb there, is a lot of people's favourites. Yeah. And as quite often happens in the story of the British monarchy, you get a good, strong king followed immediately by a terribly weak one. And that loser, cycle goes on again and again. And in fact, there's quite a lot of parallels with strong ones against weak ones. So, for example, you know, you could say that Edward II or Richard II or Henry VI are all sort of weak ones, you know. And you can say that Henry VI is among sort of the worst monarchs, because his weakness wasn't just sort of a bit embarrassing. It caused effectively a civil war.
Yes, which killed a huge amount of the population of the country he was ruling, didn't it?
Yeah, the most bloody battle that's ever taken place on English soil was in the Wars of the Roses, Towton. Battle of Towton, which we'll get to. It's going to have to be a little bit of a whistle-stop tour.
That's all right.
Because it's very complicated. That's one of the things. And it's not just a cop-out, me saying that. All historians agree. It's crazy complicated.
Well, this was the period of time that George R. R. Martin based his Game of Thrones off, isn't it?
So, well, in part, yeah. He said he picks and chooses. There's actually the French Civil War during the earlier period of the Hundred Years' War, during the reign of Henry V, that he also apparently ripped off a fair bit. But also some dynastic wars in Scotland, which is also...
But we have got that level of dynastic complication and these really complicated, convoluted family politics and power politics going on, don't we?
Just one last thing on Martin there. He has also said that, because there's the Seven Kingdoms, aren't there, in Westeros? And that's based on England hundreds and hundreds of years before this. So just to put this in context, we are talking about the 15th century. So Henry VI dates are 1421 to 1471. So he lived to be 50 years old. A bit of a spoiler alert, he does eventually get murdered. So this is where this is going to end, with his sort of untimely death. But yeah, so just to stress that this is a complicated period. If you look at just a list, say on Wikipedia or something, of the kings of England, you'll see that it goes Henry VI, Edward IV, Edward V, Richard III, Henry VII. Well, that betrays the fact that it's much more complicated than that. Henry VI himself comes and goes a couple of times. So if you look at a bit more in-depth king list, you'll see that Edward IV replaces Henry VI, then Henry VI comes back, and then Edward IV comes back. So it's complicated.
I'm generally a big fan of Edward IV. I'm a Yorkist at heart, I must say. So,
me too. Oh, one other thing I'll say. Throughout a lot of my life, being a history nerd, I've sort of tried to come to grips with the Wars of the Roses and get everything clear exactly in my mind, who's on whose side and at what point and when do people switch sides and what's going on and where does this family suddenly come into it? What's their being? There is a good I think sometimes drama, televised or movies, can really help.
It can tell the truth better than just the raw facts sometimes, can't it?
Yeah, when it's on just on paper, and even if you've spent a long time and put a fair bit of effort into understanding it, sometimes a dramatisation, for all its shortcomings, can actually make you realise, oh, that's how it must have been, or at least to some degree. There was there's some great novels by, well, not great, but novels by Philippa Gregory called The White Queen, which is about Edward IV's wife, Elizabeth Woodville. And in though, and they made a TV adaptation of it about 10 years ago. And in that, they basically depict Edward IV as the goodie. As like an ultra Chad and a goodie. And don't necessarily have to look at it that way. Of course, if you're a Lancastrian, they're the baddies. But if you have that in mind, it's easier to sort of start framing things, because ultimately, Edward IV wins, you know, well, until his own death, and then everything's back up in the air again. So it's one way to look at it, is that the Yorkist party are sort of the goodies, if you like. But it's just one way of looking at it.
I absolutely agree with that way of looking at it, with my Yorkshire heritage.
But of course, Edward's younger brother, Richard, is thought of as a kind of a baddie almost in history. But that's the story for the generation after Henry VI.
Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves.
A couple of quotes here then. So Churchill says about the whole War of the Roses, he says, quote, "The ups and downs of fortune were so numerous and startling, the family feud so complicated, the impact of national feeling in moments of crisis so difficult to measure, that it has been the fashion to disparage this period." In other words, that even professional historians are like, oh, you know, oh, it's really complicated and messy, and we're not even sure exactly what we think about it sometimes.
But that will also be influenced by the contemporary fashions in history of Churchill's time, which were very much a modernist about nation building and so on and so forth, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, he's writing towards the end of his life. I think he's writing in the 1950s or 60s. It's certainly after World War II. It's sort of the thing he did in retirement, if in a way. Yeah. I mean, he came back to be Prime Minister again, didn't he, in the mid-50s. But after that, he sort of wrote a lot of histories. And
but I do feel there is a certain type of historian, particularly in the older days, who prefers things to be quite clear-cut and quite understandable through a more modern perspective rather than necessarily entertaining. Well, maybe people in the Middle Ages just thought about things completely differently to the way we do now. Maybe they weren't so keen on progress and that sort of thing and rationalism before it had been invented.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly... it's certainly complicated. And people, the sort of the wheel of fortune, if you like, takes funny turns where you look back at it and all the historians agree, well, that was out of left field.
Right.
No one could have guessed that those two parties would team up, say. At one point, Warwick, the kingmaker, makes a pact with his arch enemy against Edward. And it's just when you look at it just on the page, it's like, well, how did that, how does that make any sense even? But yeah, so the twists and turns. I mean, I heard someone else say that in a 20-year period, the crown passed between seven times it changed hands, which is quite a lot. Another quick quote here from Churchill who said, thus, just in the general terms about the Wars of the Roses, quote, "Thus Europe witnessed the amazing spectacle of nearly 30 years of ferocious war conducted with hardly the sack of a single town and with the mass of the common people little affected and the functions of local government very largely maintained." So with the exception of some big battles, Tewkesbury, Towton, a couple of others, where thousands of normal people died, usually they sort of took each other captive and spared each other, but not for the leadership. This is extremely bloody for the leadership. After a big battle, they sort of, whoever wins, puts... the leadership to death, all of them.
Well, this is very interesting. Happens a few times. Because I've had a, I have a theory, it's a slight tangent, that a lot of the laws and rules of war that develop in Europe are about enabling people to fight their wars and settle their differences without causing too irreparable a damage to the countryside and so on, the land that they're fighting over. If true, I would expect that to be, to have greater preponderance in a civil war. But that is surprising still that you have this long, if true, that you have this long, very vicious war in which the cities aren't sacked.
Yeah, or largely unsacked. Yeah, yeah. Certainly. Yeah. I mean, I suppose just like a civil war, if you plan to win, the area, the land will be yours, be your property. So you don't want it destroyed. It sounds maybe
a bit obvious,
if
you're if you're aiming to recruit from the same population, then you're also appealing to their hearts and minds, to use a modern phrase, which sacking a city doesn't perhaps achieve.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the Wars of the Roses has been called the Cousins' War because at least the House of York and Lancaster, they're cousins, they're cadet branch of the same Plantagenet family. And the other players in it, sort of the Beaufort family and the Nevilles and all sorts of different families, House of Gloucester, they're all cousins. They're all very closely related, very, really quite closely related. And so, it's not like the Napoleonic War or the Wars of the 20th century where it's just a total all-out balls to the wall, doesn't care how much money and treasure and blood and misery is caused. None of that matters. All that matters is winning. Well, we're not really there yet.
No, we're a long way from industrial warfare.
Yeah, and it is, as you say, the hearts and minds of people. If you want to, if you don't want to constantly be facing endless revolts, you've got to at some point. So anyway, one last quick general quote overview here. Churchill again says, quote, "Anyone who studies the argument which now tore the realm will see how easily honest men could convince themselves of either cause," end quote. So it's one of those things. Some civil wars actually rent families apart. You know, individual members of families can't decide what sort of side they're going to be on. The English Civil War, and it was a great example of that. And there's a fair few examples in the American Civil War, obviously, in the 19th century, where fathers and sons disagree on what sides to be on because it's not clear cut. And The Wars of the Roses is unfortunately one of those.
Right.
Where sort of, you know, sometimes, well, I don't want to get into it too much because it is boring and it is very complicated, but about the family tree of exactly who's descended from which son of John of Gaunt and that sort of thing. John of Gaunt, you can't help help him coming up again and again. So, all right, let's start then. So King Henry VI is the son of Henry V, the victor of Agincourt, and Catherine, Catherine Valois, the French princess. So they have this baby. Thank God it's a boy. But then when he's not even 1 year old, I think he's about 9 months old, Henry V dies out of nowhere. We've mentioned this in our series, the last episode, last epochs about the Wars of the Roses when we finally lose.
And at the time that he died, there was a state of peace between England and France. There wasn't ongoing conflict and battles and things.
No, there was. Well, was formally at peace with France, but the reality was there were still English armies because France was in the middle of a civil war. So where we'd come to an agreement with the actual French crown, the Capets, the House of Valois, there was still the other faction, John the Fearless, and that we were still at war with. So it's complicated. Mm-hmm. There's more than one faction in France. But yeah, I mean, when Henry V dies, his brothers, Gloucester and Bedford, the Duke of Bedford is the main one in France anyway, but his brothers take over, and then the little tiny baby, not even 1 year old, Henry VI, is spirited back to England, and he grows up under a council. You know, because having when you have a hereditary monarchy, it's not that rare that you might have a king ruling in their minority as a child. And so the idea that you have a council, So was Richard II had that, didn't he? He was the one at the Peasants' Revolt. So there's multiple
Edward
examples
III
of that.
As well, I think, with Roger Mortimer and his mother.
Edward III, he was just about old enough.
I think he was 12 or so.
When, because his mother had his father killed, didn't she, with the red hot poker thing. Yeah, let's not dwell on that too much. But so, yeah, so Henry VI, but it became clear that he suffered from, a mental illness.
Right.
It's just as simple as that. He had real mental illness problems, which he probably inherited from his grandfather, the old King of France, the Mad King.
Charles the Mad, isn't it?
Yeah, Charles the Mad, who thought that he might be made from glass and could shatter at any given moment. It seems that madness was passed down through Catherine to Henry VI. But one thing I was listening to just the other day saying that all the other, many of the other branches of that family descended from Catherine again, because Catherine went on to get remarried and have other children, remarried a middling Welsh knight, the surname Tudor, which we shall get to. Well, actually, we probably won't get to Henry Tudor and Owen Tudor and Jasper Tudor and all those, because that's sort of after Henry VI and the generation after. Because, of course, Henry Tudor, Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII, beats Richard III at the at Bosworth Field in 1485. And our story is only going to go up to 1471 here.
Right, okay.
But it's a big, important date, 1485, the Battle of Bosworth. I think, along with 1066, it's probably the second biggest date, you could argue.
Yeah, yeah. 1707, perhaps.
Yeah, there's a few. Bolingbroke comes over in 1399. That's a big one. But there's one book I was reading just recently, rereading, where it's about English history, and it's called 1066 to 1485. So there's sort of big battles like that, big giant battles like that. It's just great for a historian to say, from here to here. I've heard one person say that those that fought on the right side, the winning side at 1485, are sort of basically our aristocracy today. In some ways, in many ways, actually.
I've heard that said about 1066 as
There was, since 1485, there's no 1066 type epoch defining battle where, you know, the vast swathes of our aristocracy all got slaughtered on one day. So anyway, that's interesting.
Sorry,
but that's for
some
another.
People saying shame in the comments.
Okay, so perhaps we could pick up the story. in about 1450, a big date. So Henry the Sixth is already in sort of in his late 20s, about 30 years old at this point. And so one thing you've got to keep in mind here, and it's massive because it's in the background the whole time, and yet when you're reading something specific about the Wars of the Roses, or about the age of Henry the Sixth, it might be mentioned once or twice, but must keep it in mind is that we're losing all our possessions in France. And it's not just a bit embarrassing. It's massively destabilizing. And it completely undermines Henry VI's whole position.
Well, my understanding was that there were, to simplify slightly, there were two main factions in court, whereby one of them had a lot of holdings in France. And so they were keenly interested in prosecuting the war in France to the best of the crown's ability, whereas other factions in Britain weren't quite so much in possession of power and wealth, and recognised that since that was a source of influence for their opposing faction, that it was in their political interest to not be perhaps so keenly behind that war campaign.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely true. But as I'll probably say this more than once, might even get annoying, but look, as the wheel of fortune turns in the Wars of the Roses, things just completely changed. And as Churchill said, sort of startlingly so. So what you just said there is absolutely right. But only for a window of time.
Yeah.
Only for like sort of 10, 15 years could you say that's true.
Yeah.
But at the time, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. But by, well, Bedford, the Duke of Bedford, Henry V's younger brother, who was the most capable really and was sort of acted as a regent in France, for want of a better word, he dies in 1435. And at that point, sort of our whole position is starts to become very shaky. So just to fast forward through quite a few years there, and this is the whole time when Henry VI is a young man, a child and a young man. By the time of 1450, we've got very little left. Well, we still controlled big chunks of Gascony, which is actually in southern France, isn't it? Sort of southwestern France. We still have Calais. We keep Calais all the way through Henry VIII's reign. So Calais is the one little pocket which we retain the whole time. But other than that, by about 1450, we've not really got anything left. So all the great landholders of Britain that had giant land holdings in Normandy and Maine,
because they were, of course, Normans, essentially. They were French and English, much like the kings. So it was quite natural for them in that sense to have holdings in both countries.
Yeah, right. No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, historians talk a lot about this whole book's written about what it means to be Anglo-Norman. Who or who wasn't Anglo-Norman? What does that mean? Does it mean anything? Are they more Anglo than they are Norman by this point? And all that sort of thing. And what does it mean to be Norman anymore? Isn't that already out of date by the 15th century? So, yeah, all those things are up for debate and fascinating, in my opinion. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's no surprise that aristocrats of England would also have holdings. Yeah, so... So yeah, the ebb and flow of the Hundred Years' War, it's all ebbing away from us. And as I say, it's not just a bit embarrassing. It's like whole swathes of the country feel that God has deserted the Lancastrian cause. That God has given us a mad king and a weak one. He's not just mad, but he's also like comically weak. And the fact that the French have taken back nearly all their lands, God wants it that way.
Right, yeah.
You know, and lest we forget, Henry the Fifth, his father, Henry the Sixth Bolingbroke, was a usurper who usurped Richard the Second and had him murdered. So all that comes up, well, right now, really, let's jump into it. There were all sorts of riots up and down the country during this period around 1450, where people were just really discontent with what's going on. And most people know, even by this point, that the king is weak-minded. So they don't necessarily really blame him. They blame his sort of main advisors. And again, we've got to whip through this relatively quickly. The main ones are his own wife, Margaret of Anjou. So obviously a French woman, Anjou.
Always trouble.
You don't like women trying to rule kingdoms through their men. And if they're a foreigner on top of that,
So, again, a modern historian would claim that this is the classic sexism of the Middle Ages. And I think there is actually an element of truth into it, because this story does arise numerous times that, the rule is bad, it is ill rule because there is this scheming woman who is involved, who is pulling all of the strings and bringing the country to ruin. That narrative seems to have had quite a lot of power in those days.
Yeah, I would say that it's not sexism, that's an anachronism. It's just a simple fact that women aren't supposed to rule. It's as simple as that. There's no question about whether it's
in the
fair
paradigm
or
of
not.
The Middle Ages.
Yeah, that's what I mean, of course. No, that's exactly what
before
I mean.
Before that gets clear.
Yeah, I mean, there are examples. Well, there are all sorts of examples of women ruling in antiquity and all sorts of stuff, but it's usually sort of either the last resort or the woman in question has got a fantastically strong will and personality. But in this case, the fact that she's also, I mean, she was called like the bad queen, as simple as that, just the bad queen. Anyway. Somerset was the main aristocrat that she used to rule through, I suppose, if you like. Edmund Beaufort, he's one of, they quite often, always gets described as the king's and the House of York's Beaufort kinsman. That's what always comes up. There's the House of Beaufort. I mean, Margaret Beaufort is Henry the Tudor's mother. So the Beauforts are like this extremely, extremely powerful and important family that aren't absolutely directly in line to the throne at this point.
And they're Dukes of Somerset, aren't they?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So Edmund Beaufort, because there's a Bishop Beaufort, who actually kind of Winchester was the richest bishopric at the time. Mm-hmm. And he almost single-handedly funded the tail end of the Hundred Years' War for us. One of the other Beaufort boys, Edmund, is the Duke of Somerset. So where he is just completely loyal to the king, and really the seat of power is with Margaret of Anjou, because the king is kind of worthless. It's a bit harsh, but he's a bit worthless. So she conducts policy. Mm-hmm. Right. But where she's not sort of formally allowed to, you know, she's not allowed to enter parliament when it's sitting or anything like that as a woman. So she needs some sort of front man. Mm-hmm. And so Somerset is that. Mm. Okay. So the country, sort of the popular consciousness, is that Somerset is to blame. He's like not only bad, but sort of not only sort of bad and evil, but just completely inept.
Yeah.
That's how a lot of people look, and they sort of directly blamed him or his house for everything that's gone wrong. You know, God is displeased with him, you know, that sort of view. Okay, so there's some uprisings and all sorts of things that they have to put down, which just turns sort of public opinion even further against them. So there's sort of a party of opposition, an opposition party. grows up around one of the other main branches of the family.
Okay.
So it's the House of York.
Yeah.
So Henry the Fourth, Henry the Fifth, and Henry the Sixth, they're all Lancastrians. So where Henry Bolingbroke, Henry the Fourth, had usurped and murdered Richard II, the last truly complete 100% Plantagenet king, after that it's going to be disputed between various branches, various cousins. Mm-hmm. So in the first instance, it's the House of Lancaster which took control. Now, the head of the House of York was a Richard, the third Duke of York, or just Richard Duke of York. And he is a very, very strong, he's sort of the opposite of Henry the Sixth. He's sort of very, very strong, bull-headed, really. He's one of his main problems is that he has no subtlety, none.
They're a bit like the kings in the from Game of Thrones, the Starks in a way. I feel like there is some influence here in that they're portrayed as quite blunt and quite, you know, well, they say speak what's on their mind, which is given to be a Yorkshire trait.
Do you know what? It was Charles Dance in Game of Thrones. He's the head Lannister.
Yeah.
I do think of him as Richard Duke of York in some ways. I just feel like
that. He has that kind of presence, I suppose.
Yeah. No, it's funny you should mention that, because I do sort of, and there's no logical reason why I equate the two in mm-hmm. my mind vaguely, but I do. It's funny you should say it. Richard Duke of York has been made, he'd been sent off to Ireland to sort of quell the Irish. Mm-hmm. They're sort of periodically revolting against our rule. So at that point but he apparently does it in such a way that they are quieted and they kind of like him. I should probably know more about that in detail, how exactly that came about. But when he comes back, he's not sort of a hated. So, for example, when, say, Oliver Cromwell.
Oh, goodness me.
Or the.
Hated to this day.
William of Orange, say, or Henry the Second, or his marshals go over there. Uh-huh. They're hated.
Yeah.
And somehow, Richard Duke of York isn't so much. Mm. But anyway, he comes back and he. In about 1450, he comes back with a few, like about 3,000 retainers, comes to London, and is sort of very brazen. This is where he sort of, in the biggest sense, enters the stage of history. Mm-hmm. And he just brazenly says before a parliament and all the assembled nobles, Somerset is to blame for everything that's going on. You know, it's a big power play. Ooh. Somerset is the problem here. Mm-hmm. And we need to sort of get rid of him. Just before that, he'd lost Rouen, which is the capital of Normandy, which spelt the end of our rule in Normandy.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a higher watermark for him doing badly in France. Mm. So just at that moment, the Duke of York comes back and says,
chose his moment to strike.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So he sort of bid his time. And I must mention that he is an extremely senior member of the royal family. His claim to the throne is pretty good. Mm. It is pretty damn good. I mean, they call it the first prince of the blood.
Wow.
So let me just quickly find... here's York's claim. Churchill tells us, York was the son of Richard, Earl of Cambridge, the grandson of Edmund, Duke of York, a younger brother of John of Gaunt. It's quite complicated already. I wouldn't even expect anyone to follow that exactly. Right. The point is... his claim is just as good as the House of Lancaster.
Wow.
It really is sort of just as good. They're descended from, as the great-grandson of Edward III, he was the only other person beside Henry VI with an unbroken male descent from Edward III.
Crikey.
So there you go. He's not just a complete pretender.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, as I said, that reasonable men still couldn't really make up their mind his claim. Because... well, there's one sort of a great line where Henry VI has said, but I'm an anointed king.
Mm-hmm.
I've been coronated a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
My father was king. His father was king.
Mm-hmm.
How is this happening? Mm-hmm. And the Yorkist faction will say, well, it doesn't matter how much time has passed. Your grandfather was a usurper. You're simply the wrong family.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter that 3 generations have passed and you've been coronated and anointed. None of that matters. So... it's interesting, isn't it? And of course, underlying it all is power and money. It's not just about the genealogy.
Yeah.
It's also about, you know, like the realpolitik, who's actually won the last big battle, who's got an army in the field and who hasn't.
And I imagine as well, there's a certain amount of the determinism that you tend to see in highly religious societies in that, well, if this is the anointed king chosen by God, then how come he's getting a kicking in France and he doesn't even know his own mind and he's ruled by his wife and so on? I think these can be persuasive arguments that the mandate of heaven, to use the Oriental phrase, has slipped.
Yeah. No, people say, yeah, well, you are ordained by God, and God has now withdrawn his pleasure with you. He's now displeased with you.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.